Good evening, y'all, and welcome to Yada Yada Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We've got our normal cast of characters. JB has avoided any spills this week. How are you, fella?
Doing good.
Good. And we have Kirk, who is going to be the chief presenter on our observations program that we'll record over the weekend on Sunday. He is going to be smirching the U.S. government. How dare you?
I know, it's the rule.
Come up with an easier topic?
That's right. And Larry has been busy gifting used engines to...
Mr. Loyal over here.
Yep.
Mr. Loyal. Just call me Mr. Loyal. Let me tell you guys something. You probably don't know this about me.
Yeah.
But I was a Chicago Cubs fan for nearly 25 years.
Wow. That's the epitome of loyal.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing else like it. I mean,
go
Cubs.
If you look at the last, like, 20 years, I've been a Dodger fan, and the Dodgers haven't won squat in 20 years. And even being an SC football fan, it's been rough here for we've been through a rough patch, but nothing compares to the rough patch the Cubs have gone through.
Hey, let me tell you something. When I look at Christians that are quoting the Bible, and I'm going to tell you this, they remind me of the Chicago Cubs. They really do. Man, they look like they got beat before they ever got started.
Well, it's true. You know, by way of update, I was finally been able to pull all of my various files on all of the chapters for all of the books together in one place, so that I can begin to work on them, and others can help me on the edits of them, and can write no matter where I might be, because I kind of have a tendency to move around a lot, and there's multiple computers, and you never know where your files are. But I set them all up in a Dropbox, I'm pulling them down and working on them from the Dropbox and uploading them again. So that's been helpful, and I'm making significant progress now again on that the opening chapter of Observations, which is on Proverbs 6. Finding that there's lots to say, and it begins really with a condemnation of religion and politics, of when you're considering the fact that this letter is written from God to us about the adversarial conditions and opposition that exists outside of his family as part of human institutions. It is astonishing that fewer than one in a million people have taken the time to closely examine and carefully consider what God has to say in Proverbs 6.
I've been on a rather lengthy debate here. It's on Lindsey Van Roy's page about a guy who keeps going to the Septuagint and telling us, no, Jesus has a name. Because I said, you know, Jesus means nothing in any language. Hesus meant earth pig, but, you know,
right.
Jesus doesn't mean anything. And he says, oh, yes, in the Septuagint. I said, you're a liar, sir. In the Septuagint, they use placeholders. There's no Jesus in the Septuagint.
That's right.
I mean, these guys lie just straight off the top. The Septuagint. And why would anybody go to the Septuagint when they can just go to the Hebrew?
Yeah, I think it's because Christians despise Hebrew. That's the reason.
It's like Christians despise Roman Catholic.
Yeah. And what did Rome do when they following the 133 to 135 uprising in Yehuda, what did Rome do to any document found written in Hebrew?
They burned it.
Well, they burned it with somebody in it, too.
They do. They did. They took the most knowledgeable experts on the Hebrew in the Hebrew language, and they wrapped them in scrolls, particularly of the Torah and prophets, that were soaked so that they were moist, so that the person they were burning would roast alive over an agonizing period of time. And, you know, if you look at the things like the Edict of Milan, which is really the beginning of Roman Catholicism and the transition from Imperial Rome to Roman Catholic Rome, the the Edict of Milan essentially said that all religions are the same and all religions are acceptable, but you damn well better not do anything that is encouraged in the Hebrew Torah. That is punishable by death. But every religion otherwise is the same and fully acceptable. You know, that's, so when you're pontificating out of the Septuagint, what you're doing is you're playing right into the hands of the most despicable regime that has ever existed, Imperial Rome transitioning to the Roman Catholic Church. And, you know, and think about it for a moment. The rumor is, and it's been completely discredited, that the Septuagint is called the Septuagint because 70 rabbis got together to translate the Torah from Hebrew into Greek in Alexandria because too few Jews in Alexandria spoke Hebrew. And the letter that explains the process for which the Septuagint is named has been shown to be a complete and utter fraud, and yet it's still called the Septuagint. And there is no copy of it that predates about 100 BCE, and even then the copies are few and far between. And that by 100 CE to 150 CE, somewhere in that period, the Septuagint, this Greek translation, if you will, of the Hebrew, became so divergent. They were so sloppy. They were so inconsistent that Origen devoted most of his life to the Hextapla project, which was to take the four oldest copies that he could find and blended them together to create one because they were so divergent. And so we do not have his blended version, by the way. We've got nothing from the Septuagint that really predates anything in the Dead Sea Scroll collection. And it's, Larry's correct that one of the great misnomers about the Septuagint is that this notion that it presents these names in Greek, but it doesn't. You know, placeholders were used. And the placeholders...
You know what these clowns do? They read a commentary, and they'll see a placeholder for Yahusha. They'll write Jesus in their little commentary. That's what they do.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is that the older versions of the Septuagint, those dating to about 50 CE and before, they actually used Hebrew letters for Yahweh's name and for Yahusha's name. They didn't use Greek placeholders. They actually wrote the names in Hebrew.
Yes, I know.
And then it was only thereafter that the scribes in Alexandria that were now Christian scribes changed the Hebrew right names into the Greek placeholders. So to make a name claim based upon the Septuagint belies the reality that it was a wholly and completely untrustworthy document by the time that it became prevalent enough to use, and that names were never written out in it. And when they were, well, they were never. They were originally, but they were written in Hebrew.
You know,
in the midst of the Greek text.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of 2nd and 3rd century documents, and they use placeholders there too. So, you know, it must have been, they probably never changed them until about 4th century.
Literally
100% all copies of the Septuagint and 100% of the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and midway through the 4th century copies of the Greek witness writings. They were 100% of them on every page used placeholders. There isn't a single example of a single manuscript dating prior to 450 CE that didn't use placeholders. As a matter of fact, the two most comprehensive manuscripts, those the Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. Both of them were written post-Constantine, compiled post-Constantine, and there isn't a single exception on any page in the entire manuscript of either one where the names are written out. They are placeholders ubiquitously all the way through. So, this case that that Jesus' is name, or Christ as a name, appears in the earliest writings in Greek is absolutely ridiculous. And the first
By the way, Lindsay has just posted this in this debate, the show. So hopefully they'll listen to it. There's no Jesus written in the Septuagint. There's no Lord.
In fact, you know what's the most amazing about that is just, again, it belies a total ignorance on behalf of the person who is making the claim, because how would you convey the J sound of Jesus
when it didn't exist?
Alphabet?
Yeah, it didn't exist in any language. Forget Greek.
No, the letter J as a hard J sound wasn't invented until the 17th century. So you couldn't find it in a copy of the Septuagint. Hmm. Now, you have to wonder, when somebody's trying to make that kind of a claim, what in the world were they thinking? And then it goes beyond that to say, so you mean to tell me that you hate Hebrew so much that somebody who is decidedly Hebrew, who spoke Hebrew, and who is the living embodiment of the Hebrew Torah, you're going to give that person a Greek name? You think that person had a Greek name?
The Hebrew Messiah had a Greek name. Yeah. That makes sense to me, surely.
So you've got all of these, and even his disciples. You've got Matthias, you know, Shimon, and you're going to tell me that, and Jacob, and you're going to tell me that they were followers, and they were all followers of a Greek?
Yeah, right.
And the Greek had a last name, by the way, that none of them had last names, but this Greek, yeah, he had a last name, and his last name was Christ, which means drugged.
Yeah, it's also derived from Krishna, or San Christ in the classical, which is the Eastern sun god, and Holy was his consort.
Yeah, well, it's the root of it in Greek is chryso, which means to apply drugs. That's why it's
to your eyes.
High is the symbol of all drugstores and for pharmacies around the world.
Yeah, well, he gets the more of them.
What it says is that I hate the Hebrew underpinnings of Yahweh's testimony so much that I'm going to promote absolutely irrational and ignorant lies for no purpose other than to show my utter hatred towards the language that Yahweh chose to reveal himself in.
Right. And spoke the universe into existence with, by the way.
Correct.
You know, so we'll hate that language and go with any.
We don't have any indication anywhere that Yahweh has ever spoken any language other than Hebrew, or that he has inspired anyone to write in any language other than Hebrew. There is two very, very finite applications of Aramaic. And in that case, what we find is that if you could speak and write Aramaic, you could speak and write Hebrew. The words, both nouns and verbs, phraseology, almost identical.
It's about the equivalent of British English and American English.
They are that similar.
You can understand the person pretty well. There may be a few little differences, but
you know,
if you speak one, you know the other.
Right. Like, for example, there's kun with the K-U-W N and Kuhn with a Q-U-W-M. And the differences between the two would be, do you start the word with the K or the Q pronounced almost identically? So that is the relationship between them. But there is nothing that is ever recorded that God said in Greek, ever. And so to pretend that he did, and then to pretend that there is a Greek name, Jesus, I mean, you are so ignorant, so irrational, as to be too pathetic to open your mouth and try to mislead others. Just don't do it. Give up. You know, if you've got a lie to justify your religion, then your religion isn't justifiable. All right. You know, and the other thing, beyond all that, the thing that is so tragic about Jesus Christ and Christian is what you have to forego to accept it. The truth is magnificent. The truth is that his name is Yahusha, which means that he is Yahweh saving us. That is so profound. So,
well, no, I mean, it's slightly important. That, remember, he chided the rabbis in Malachi for saying, you know, you people overlook my presence in the Torah.
You're right.
What you know, he's talking about Yahusha, my very presence, you overlook it.
Right.
Wow. I mean, so let's turn Yahusha to Jesus, even though Yahweh says part of being cut into the family covenant is the love of his name. So when you write Masayah, Yahusha, Yahweh, you know, you see all those Yahs in there for some reason.
Yes, for example, what it tells you is that there is no Trinity. There's no multiple persons and a Godhead. That there is but one God. He has but one name. And all Yahusha means is that Yahweh, God's one and only name, is invested in the process of saving us.
Yeah, doesn't he say in Zechariah, when upon his return, doesn't he say, and from that point on, I'll be known as Yahweh, my one and only name?
He introduced himself to Moshe. He says, yeah, it was the one and only name that I want to be remembered and proclaimed.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Hello?
Let me ask you a question. This week we listened to the last tape you did with Stan, the one that my wife heard.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, the one where he
banned
me forever.
And you also presented that to him, and he actually understood that.
Yeah.
He stayed right there. I mean... Even if they get it, they walk away. It's just must have disrupted his callers. Must have hit him so hard.
They did.
After your show, that they just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, it was the most, according to his wife, it was the most responded to show in the history of his program. And while I do not know the percentage that said, "Wow, this is profound and important," there were enough that said, you know, this is so anti-Christianity, and therefore we don't want any part of it, and if you continue, we will never listen to you again, that in the choice between truth and audience, he chose audience.
Yeah, because he's so
which is going to be typical. Isn't that what Jerry Falwell did with you?
Sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. He recognized the truth, but in the choice between truth and audience, he chose audience.
I think Bill Williams on the phone with us too, by the way.
Okay.
Yes.
Hey, William. Hey, Kurt. How you doing?
Good.
Larry and Yada. JB.
Yeah. By the way, I'm back to Proverbs 6. That was the one I think you had sent me, wanting to know about the nature of the whorish woman.
Correct. Yeah, so that's been, it's been very insightful. Thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah, I'm a long way from, I finished the translation, as you know. Now I'm going back and doing the commentary on it and having a good time doing that. It's going to be several weeks before I get that all down, but it turned out to be just a marvelous way to introduce the new volume called Observations, because it was quickly states the difference between what it's like to be part of his family, and what how the rest of the world is in opposition to it. So it,
right.
it provides the proper perspective from which to observe Yahweh's testimony.
Well, I got to tell you that first show was very impressive with Roy Goodman.
Yeah.
I in fact posted that on my FB page because I think it was profound, and it's just pretty cool hearing a scientist validate that Yahweh is the creator. It's just real cool. I mean, you don't hear many scientists having that discussion in a public forum.
Yeah, one thing I like about Roy's insights too is that he doesn't shade anything. You know, he talks very openly about, you know, here are the problems with the scientific explanation. Here's the consistency and the brilliance of Yahweh's explanation and how all this worked out. But if there's areas where there is overlap between the two, or there is a feasible explanation amongst the scientific approach, he's very comfortable sharing it and talking about its probability. And so I think that discussion that he had with us about the fact that DNA has been front-loaded to enable animal life to cope with challenges. That was a profound aspect of it. Maybe the second most difficult part to understand. The most difficult is the part that I had an obligation, so I had to leave because I read it several times, and I'm not sure I understand chaos theory. So putting chaos theory aside for a moment, the most challenging part of that discussion, in my view, was the front-loading of DNA to enable an upward migration in the genome, recognizing that a random mutation in the genome is going to produce a negative result 99.99% of the time, so that there is no way, based upon natural selection, to add information to the genome that enables animals to evolve to more sophisticated animals.
Now, they can only lose genetic material.
They lose genetic material. Mm-hmm. So what Yahweh did, recognizing that animals would have challenges coping with a changing environment, and by environment I don't mean just weather, but there's so many things that go into our natural. We really have to learn to cope. That's part of the growing and evolving ourselves and our own understanding, is that it puts us in a position to cope with our environment. But what Yahweh appears to have done, because there's no other explanation for this, he loaded our DNA with the capacity to allow upward migration. And this notion that the vast preponderance of our DNA, we do not understand what it does or why it is there, but what we're discovering is it's there to enable this very capability. So that, you know, God gave us a capability of becoming more capable than we would otherwise, because the natural course of things is to deteriorate. He didn't want us spiraling down, and all of his creation spiraling down into death and destruction without a fighting chance. And so he loaded our DNA with this capability of evolving in a positive direction.
Let me ask you something. It's that's fine that he's preloaded everything in the DNA so that it can do that, but I still have problems without him intervening from time to time. How can you get from this chump of this type of animal to that one without having any fossil
record? Yeah, and that's one of the things that Roy has written several responses. I don't know. I think they've probably been posted.
Yeah, I've been getting them now.
Yeah, and what his view there is. Is one where he recognizes that there are two options, and he is presenting both options. I personally was in the camp of Yahweh designed a multivariable program equation that was perfectly calculated to put precisely the amount of energy into the creation of the universe to produce the result that he desired over the time span that he desired.
Mm-hmm.
And while there is room for that in terms of, which, you know, boggles our mind, but again, if you look at this as we're a 3.5-dimensional character that can conceive non-life, but we can conceive and generate activity in a two-dimensional realm, and how little that takes of us to be able to draw a picture, for example, in a two-dimensional realm, some more of higher quality and with greater ease than others, Kirk. But when you realize that we can create a two-dimensional world as a three-dimensional construct, that's what he was doing. He's a seven-dimensional construct creating a six-dimensional entity of which we operate knowingly in 3.5 dimensions. Now, my original thought was he front-loaded everything that was required, but I think that is short of reality. We know that Yahweh has intervened in human activity.
Yep.
We know specifically that he intervened with Adam. We know that he intervened with Noah. We know that he intervened with Abraham and Sarah. We know that he intervened with Moshe and the children of Israel, and with Yishak and with Jacob. And we know he intervened with his prophets. And then we know that he intervened again in an extraordinary way in year 4000 Yah, fulfilling the Moed as the greater light. And we know he's going to return. And we know he's going to play a very active role in truncating the Magog War and in ending the War of Armageddon. So he can and does intervene. Now, the challenge for someone like Roy is because once he comes up with a hypothesis, it needs to be consistent. And so he recognizes that a seven-dimensional construct cannot enter a six-dimensional realm. And that would be like Walt Disney can't enter the realm of Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck. But that is not to say that a seven-dimensional entity can't set apart part of himself, diminish that aspect of himself, and interact with that which he's creating. You know, in a limited way, we can't create life in our paintings, but your brushstrokes, Kirk, mm-hmm. are in a way interacting.
Sure.
But we know that Yahweh has set apart part of himself, diminished that aspect of himself to interact with his creation. That being the case, there's a reason that each day along the way, and even during each day of creation, that he didn't fine-tune and act. For example, when he went from plant to animal life, he very well could have designed DNA at that point. And then when he refined the various phyla of animal life, he could have taken the alphabet that of life that he had conceived and ordered it in such a way that it resulted in the kind of beings he wanted to create.
Yeah.
So I think that the answer is both. He calculated and implemented the right amount of energy in the precisely proper way to get the end result that he wanted, and he, as creator, enjoys intervening up to the point of in any way truncating choice and free will.
Okay, now let me ask you a question regarding that. You've got Adam, who is a created being. You have, and maybe he tinkered with the primordial soup that gave us the first walking human beings. the ones without.
Yeah, I don't think Adam was the first human. I just think Adam
We know that. I mean, these were without an Asama.
Yes.
That crowd, and then you have him, and everything's fine as long as they don't intermarry with them.
Right.
Now, when Cain breaks away and he does take wives or take or reproduces
right.
with them, now you've
right.
got a animalistic, pretty rough character.
Right.
DNA that all of a sudden
right.
has a brilliant brain.
Yeah,
now you got a hybrid.
The reason. Right.
Okay, now you have a hybrid.
You do.
So
right.
if that being the case, then that's like instantly starts becoming mass destruction.
Yes, it does. Very quickly.
Because that's what brings us to this story.
That is correct.
So now let me ask you one other question, because I put this to Roy and he didn't answer me back yet, but I'll probably talk to him later. When Noah has these three sons, and we know in which direction they went for the most part, Ham is from Asia to Africa, and then we have Japheth going off towards perhaps to Europe in bulk, larger quantity of his family, and so forth, and then we've got Shem probably hanging around for the most part near Israel.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We don't know, because it was a regional flood, we don't know how many human beings without an Asama are out there. Now,
correct.
And now, and because the spaces now are greatly, it's not all in one little concentrated area, now they're all over the place, multiple continents. If these people, as they left, married again or took wives among them or husbands, now you've got another hybrid.
Correct.
You, now, maybe that explains, because one of the things, and what we'll be talking about in the show, I'm sure.
But think, Kirk, you know, from the time of Adam and Chawla's expulsion from the garden to the time mm-hmm. of Noah is 1,000 years. It took
right.
about 1,000 years for man's arrogance to spread
totally.
To the point that he was a chaotic, counterproductive, vicious, duplicitous
yes.
being. All right. Now,
mm-hmm.
from the time of Noah
mm-hmm.
to the time that Yahweh is pulling Abram out of Babylon, was he pulling him out of Babylon? Because Babylon and Assyria and Ur and at the time Egypt were charming places where people were multicultural and in love with each other and mutually supportive
of all humanities, yeah.
Egotistical kings, demented religious leaders that would think nothing of mass murder, were conquering everyone that they could pack to death and enslave for the purpose
right.
of self-aggrandizement.
Right.
Did it take the same amount of time, didn't it? Took 1,000 years.
I think the only difference is now that we've got 5,000 years since that period of Noah, you've been able to escape for a while, moving to here, to there, to yonder, you know, because of the
yeah.
land masses being so great. And now we
yeah.
don't. Now we can't.
Yeah, and by the way, look at it again. It took about another 1,000 years, and Israel grew and flourished, particularly
mm-hmm.
under Dodd. But at the end of that 1,000 years, Babylon and Assyria and Egypt and the et al. Were once again deadly and vicious and preying on
right.
Yah's creation, on his children. And, you know, you go 1,000 years from there, and now you've got Greece and Rome and
mm-hmm.
Persia. All being extraordinarily vicious and evil, this mix of militarism and politics and religion, all being back in the same kind of evil soup.
Yeah. So I think
right, so it's.
I mean, I don't have to reach very far to figure out this. Now, whether
you know, 1,000 years
they
later, we're in
somebody
the same part of the world, we're in the midst of the Crusades, you know, with Muslims and Christians trying to carve up the same slice of territory.
Yeah. I just
and 1,000 years after
thing.
That, we find ourselves here today with the same territory being raw and tooth and claw with rape and pedophilia and mass murder and terror and torture, enslavement of little girls being commonplace.
It's just hard to fathom.
You're leading to a question there, but the timing of all this and how fast it occurred and the cycle that occurred just was interesting to me.
Yeah. No, the only question I had was what I was trying to. I was always looking for motives. You know, how do you turn into that? I mean, do you do it? Do
what is the motive of the fellow that Larry was mentioning that says mm-hmm. that Jesus is in the Septuagint? What's the motive?
Right.
He wants to advance his personal deluded religious belief. That's all it is.
Right. Yep, because if he can do that, then he can impose his will on others, saying, you know, he's right, they're wrong.
Yeah, his words were above Yahweh's. I even showed him that, Yahweh said very clearly, he's awesome and astonishing on account of the presence of my name. Now, how you get Yah out of Jesus is beyond me. I can certainly see it in Yahusha. You know.
Yeah, sure.
So how does Jesus come in his name?
I have no idea. Well, it doesn't Zeus. Mean anything.
You know, it's Craig says, unless he's Zeus.
How can he come in a name whose sounds wouldn't be invented for another 1,700 mm-hmm. years?
Yeah, well, you know, we know who he is. That's why Yahweh told us, as you know, Craig, not to read the published material of the wild boar.
Oh,
you
know,
exactly. Yeah.
Larry,
one of the things that just strikes me about the whole thing is the moronic nature of that. Why would you spend any amount of time to identify a diminished manifestation of God when you can actually know God? Why would you do that?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. That's part of knowing God is understanding that he took the beating, you know,
right.
A diminished part of him took the beating. I don't, and along with the
right.
the Ruach, Kodesh.
Right. Why go there?
So,
why care?
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's just say you're right, or you're not. Who gives a crap?
It's not only that, you know, Yahweh, and that's a good point, because Yahweh said not to focus on his physical manifestation, but on the entirety
right.
of his spiritual endeavors, which
right.
would be the seven Moed Mikra, not
right.
the, you know, four or three.
Right.
Three,
right.
That's what they focus on.
Do you ever wonder why Yahusha never referred to himself as the Son of God?
Because he was.
Why he never called himself God?
Yeah,
you ever wonder why he always refers to himself as the Son of Man? You ever wonder why?
Well,
I don't.
Yeah.
I do too.
Just as God. He didn't
right.
want us turning to him as God.
Right. Yep. He was saying, "I'm the physical manifestation. That's all. That's what it is. I'm here to do a job." You know.
Father's
yeah.
greater. No.
Yeah. I'm a diminished manifestation of Yahweh. The Father is greater than I. Why are you asking me? What did the Father write? Yeah. But you know, the other thing that is so amazing about the whole thing
mm-hmm.
is that to be an advocate of Jesus and of Christianity, you have to come to the conclusion or assume or believe that God authored a plan that turned out to be
wrong.
That he failed, and that he came up with a really crappy plan that he said was going to be eternal and everlasting, and that he wanted you to observe forever. And he came up with this plan, and every aspect of that plan was wrong, impotent, and that. This said God, who failed entirely in his plan, who came up with a plan that no one could follow, that just failed in every possible way, that this same God then came up with a new plan that he himself did not articulate but got this murderous pig of a man named Paul to articulate on his behalf that contradicts everything he said before. Now, why would anybody in their right mind think that could possibly be true?
They're not in the right mind.
Absolutely.
Well, and even if it was true, how could you
possibly think that
trust
that
God?
Concept is valid?
Well, like I said, if it was true, you couldn't possibly trust that God.
If it was true, the God who came up with the new plan based upon annulling the old plan would not be trustworthy. That is correct. You'd have to be a nincompoop to trust that God. Because that God said, in essence, if you want to believe Paul, is that my old plan stinks. It was pornography. It could not save. And so I had to come to this fellow Paul to come up with a new plan. And this plan, I'm not going to prove its legitimacy. I'm not going to use any prophecy of any kind to prove its legitimacy. You just take it on faith. And what you need to believe is that I had a senior moment in my old plan. But this guy, he figured it out for me, and you can trust
He's
him.
He's a lot smarter than I am.
Yeah.
We got this all taken care of.
Yeah. The guy that claims that he's insane, that he's demon-possessed, that he is a pervert, that can't write worth a damn, that's egotistical to a fault, that he's got it all figured out.
And he consistently informs us that he's a... I'm sorry.
Not saying Paul, he was so brilliant in everything else he did, too. You can... What a guy.
Yeah, what
didn't
anything. Yeah,
those who knew him best, you know, there's a common thread between Muhammad and Paul. Those who knew him best despised him. That's what he wrote in Timothy. And at his end, he says, I have no one. Everyone's abandoned me. Those who knew him best despised him. Read the Quran. Those who knew Muhammad best knew that he was a con. You know, it took a lot of manipulation, a whole pile of lies, conditioning society to dumb people down to the point where they just acquiesce. And they put up their little Christmas trees, and they put up their little Christmas lights, and they sing their little hymns, and they go to their little churches, and they all pretend like they're pleasing God. It takes a lot of indoctrination, a lot of evil, a lot of corruption, a lot of lies. To get from absolutely burying the truth to a lie this elaborately woven. You know, what I say so many times is, you know, that Christians will chafe at the idea that Paul, not Jesus, founded their religion. But you don't have to be all that smart to realize that that's statement is inarguable. That Yosha was Torah observant. His every word was Torah affirming. He lived the Torah. He was the living embodiment of the Torah. He came to fulfill the Torah. And so if you're not Torah observant, then you haven't a clue.
Well, then
who he was, what he did.
The only way to
said.
The Father is through him. Right?
Right. You can't follow him unless you follow the Torah.
Because he was the
Torah.
And
the
Torah.
Moment you follow the Torah, the moment you observe the Torah, the moment you view the Torah as he did, you cease to be a Christian.
That's right. Yep.
So you have to be absolutely and completely irrational to associate Jesus, even by the right name, as Yosha, Christianity. The religion of Christianity was founded by and advanced by Paul and
Liars.
The Imperial Rome that became the Roman Catholic Church.
Hey, let us not forget Marcion.
Yeah,
Marcion played a role for sure in promoting Paul, but you know, Marcus Garvin's role was not much more than the role played by any of the emperors in Rome, and in the sense of the leaders of Roman Catholicism recognized that they could fashion a religion that would be ubiquitous, that would be unifying and ultimately empowering if they incorporated every religious lie that was popular into their religion. And Marcion was a Gnostic who loved the Gnosticism of Paul that advanced that. And Roman Catholicism, while renouncing Marcion because he was a threat to them, accepted his religious notions.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, though, Marcion, you know, I mean, obviously his first, quote, New Testament was nothing but Paul's writings and some writings from Paul's historian, Luke, claimed that the name of the Jewish God was Demiurge. Demiurge, even though it's YHWH 7,000 times. And he claimed that the Jewish God was dead. Wow. God died.
Right.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Because Marcion, like this idiot that is promoting Jesus out of the Septuagint, hates all things associated with Hebrew. And the reason they hate all things associated with Hebrew is that Yahweh reveals himself in Hebrew. His Torah teaching is written in Hebrew. He identifies himself in Hebrew. He has a Hebrew name. And so if you oppose Hebrew, you're opposing everything that Yahweh is literally the embodiment of his word, and you're in opposition to it.
Mm-hmm.
Marcion was hateful of those things. The Greeks and the Romans despised Hebrews. They despised Hebrew, and they despised Hebrews. And the church that grew out of these things has never changed. Now, you think about, too, that the Greek culture. Today, Greece is the single most anti-Semitic country on earth.
Yes, it is.
And sure is. Greece is, you know, when Rome, the Empire of Rome, Imperial Rome, the most deadly of, the second most deadly of beasts, conquered Greece, the Greek religion and philosophy ended up overpowering the Roman religion and philosophy. And so the Greeks became what they ate. Excuse me, the Romans became what they ate. The Romans essentially became Greek, which is why when Rome died, it was furthered in Constantinople, which was the Greek or Eastern Empire. And that's where it thrived. And it's in the Greek incarnation of Rome that we find the beginnings of Roman Catholicism. And so the Greek mindset, just like the Roman mindset, is wholly and completely opposed to Hebrew and to Yahweh's testimony in Hebrew and to the very God of the Hebrews, who is Yahweh.
Well, it's very hard to rewrite the Hebrew. You know, to say the things that you wanted to say. I mean, I understand the rabbis overlooked the fulfillment of the Moed, but they can't look at the Moed Mikra and say, look, upon this rock I will establish my Moed Mikra. They have to say church. So, you know, I mean, otherwise they're stuck with these
right.
seven called out assemblies. So
right.
they have to jump through a lot of hoops. And the best way to do that is say, well, this is just a translation, you know.
Right. Is to deceive. Is to confuse. Babel. That's why the book is called the Bible. It's named after the Hebrew word to confuse. Babel, which means with Bel, with the Lord. And that is what they have done. One of the things that is just so astonishing me to, you know, we're talking about the idiocy of Christianity, is that they carry around in their Babel, 3/4
what
of
they
it.
Call an Old Testament.
Testament.
Yeah.
Why do they do that when their New Testament is wholly and completely contradictory to it, refutes every aspect of it?
But that's the only part of their Bible that gives it any legitimacy. It's
that's
the only
the
part
why they
with
do
the
it.
Prophecy. It's the only part with the accuracy.
Correct.
You know, I asked a preacher that one day. You know what he told me? Well, it just gives us kind of a brief, it kind of gives us a history. That was it. That's what it
is. Yeah,
it's funny.
It
provides the opposite.
It provides a
the
history.
Old Testament
past, present,
is Scripture, and the New Testament is history.
Yeah,
the New Testament, more accurately,
Torah provides a history of about 15 billion years, give or take. A decade or two. Pretty good history, yeah. Provides us.
Well,
yeah,
I mean, he was trying to make the understatement of the decade.
As a historical document than the Old Testament would. The Old Testament, or what was referred to as Old Testament, you can qualify as Scripture, but the Greek text, you know, the eyewitness accounts, are literally nothing more than a historical recording of what happened. So really,
correct.
He's got it completely backwards.
Well,
the New Testament is the history. That's
well,
history,
you know, there is a lot of history, past, present, and future, in the Torah prophecy.
Oh, yeah, it covers
Psalms.
It. But
yeah, and there's a lot of non-history, and
history.
Particularly in the Pauline writings, there's a lot of non-history there. But, you know, the one of the things that I've come to appreciate more and more with the concept of prophecy and of history is the realization that from Yahweh's perspective, prophecy doesn't always mean predicting the future. A prophecy is a presentation of history, and that history can be past, present, or future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so prophecy, from Yahweh's point of view, is simply reporting on the important aspects for us to understand of history, regardless of when they occurred, or if they have even occurred. And that brings us to what Roy originally wrote as what he thought was the most controversial statement that he made along the way in the interview we did together. And that was, he made the statement that in the seventh dimension, Yahweh does not know his future. And what he said is that while Yahweh knows and the whether we are a 3.5 or a 6-dimensional construct, he says that, well, Yahweh knows our past, present, and future because our time moves much more quickly than his time. That if we were looking at him from our perspective, he would seem to be stationary, and we would be seeming just to be buzzing about it at this incredible pace, having the lifespan of a nap. The idea that Yahweh cannot see his future in the seventh dimension, I think is not only accurate, but tantalizing.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think it's accurate and tantalizing is that if Yahweh in the seventh dimension could see his own future, what would be the enjoyment of living it out?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the...
You know, there's another aspect to that. I don't know if you thought of it. You know, of the billions that have walked the planet, he says thousands find his mercy. I would find it also very telling that, you know, that the thousands that find the mercy, these are people that seriously considered his words and acted upon them. So basically, he's being surrounded by people that are loyal to the cause, if you will.
Yeah.
And
are supportive of and accepting of what he has. Well,
that's probably a better way to put it.
Sure. Accepting and acting upon his plan. But think of this of ourselves, Larry. We're now have transitioned mortality and the physical world, the material world, and the decay that exists and the limitations. And we're now in a new universe with Yahweh. Would you want to know instantly your future for all eternity? Or would you want to play it out?
No, that would be fairly boring, to say the least. No, I wouldn't like that. I don't think
I wouldn't
anybody...
Like it. I want to play it out. Can you imagine if you knew how all eternity was going to go the instant you arrived at eternity? You knew every decision, every act that you were going to make, what the result was going to be for all time? What would be the purpose? What would be the joy? What would you do during eternity if you knew how it's all going to turn out?
I think you literally just described my idea of hell.
Yes, exactly. So Roy, I don't think stumbled, I don't think that's the right word, but Roy was thinking about time, and it led him to that conclusion. And it's like so many things that I had never thought of before, but when it's presented intelligently, which Roy did, and Roy, if you're listening and I'm not articulating accurately your thought, then I apologize, but where it led me was, of course, it has to be that way. If Yanoa knew, or even could know, his future in the seventh dimension, then eternity would be hellish. There'd be no purpose to it. There'd be no purpose to anything. I'd say you want to be able to have an eternity where we still have free will, where we make choices, and where the things that we do have a consequence, where they cause something to happen, something that's observable, something that is perceivable, something that is interesting, and you want to pursue it to see how it turns out. And you want to do that on a small scale and on a big scale and in every imaginable environment just to see how it turns out. And then you want to come back and you want to share what you discovered. That's why I think we're still going to be under the 6+1 plan and have the annual 7 meetings. Is we're going to come back, and when one day every week we're, you know, there'll be a seventh dimension time clock, and we're going to come back and we're going to share what we did while we were apart.
I never thought about that until you mentioned it, but that actually just sounds so appealing to me. I never thought about that. It just sounds like a great way to spend eternity.
Yeah. And in Roy's way, Roy came up with the realization that if you're going to be consistent about time and the relative nature of time and of dimensions, then this is a condition that must be applied to Yahweh. And he did not extrapolate as to what that means. You know, how does it affect us, him, and life eternal? Now, I've done the extrapolation. I'm not claiming my extrapolation is as thoughtful or as well-reasoned as Roy's hypothesis regarding seven-dimensional time. But, you know, the difference with me is that everything that I learned from Yahweh or about Yahweh only becomes interesting to me when I can apply it. And I apply it all to the covenant and to his nature and to spending an eternity with him. And when I do that, what Roy had to reveal is very exciting.
Mm-hmm. But doesn't the Torah confirm that, what Roy was sharing with us? I mean, isn't that why Yahweh destroyed mankind the first time, right? I mean, he said he regretted making man, right? So if he knew that we were going to turn out that way, he wouldn't have made us, probably. Who knows? I mean, he had a regret about it.
It is possible that even though Yahweh could see the entirety of his six-dimensional construct, at the moment that he conceived the universe and life in it, it is very possible that Yahweh chose not to witness the future beyond a certain point and wanted to see it play out in real time, if you will. And so then he absolutely would have been able to create the universe with all the right intentions and then to grieve with his experiment once it turned bad, as it is being reported here, 1,000 years after Adam and Chawa were booted from the garden. And by this way, you know, Yahweh has a lot of time invested into this. At this point, we are 6,000 years from running the clock on time as we know it.
And but the Torah is always the remedy. See, and that's why, even though there'll be mistakes, the Torah is the correction all the time.
Right.
So
It's the empowerment.
He doesn't have to worry.
It's the enlightenment, right. It is the perfection. It is always the solution to those things. Now, it's my conclusion that based upon Yahweh eliminating all humankind within the Soma and thus rooting out evil, because I don't think animals are capable of evil. Until you have a Nesama and can reason and plot and exercise judgment, both good and bad, if you're just an animal, animals do not act in an evil fashion. You don't very often see an animal kill for fun. They killed the.
Have you ever seen my cat and lizards? And how about what she did to my couch?
Your couch isn't
right.
Your couch isn't alive.
Well, cats are evil.
Even if it was made with naga hide, the great extinct naga. The fact of the matter is that the only animals that will play with their food are animals that are typically fed. So that hunting is now a sport as opposed to a necessity. So we have conditioned them to that animals are not evil, but humans were diagnosed by Yahweh, described by Yahweh as evil. And I think what Yahweh recognized is that if he did not reboot the system, that there would not be the opportunity to have a family like Abram and Abraham and Sarah, Yishak and Jacob, to be able to disseminate his instructions through, his covenant through, his opportunity through, in a way that the thousands of people would accept it. And so he had to rid the swamp of the infectious disease that had poisoned it, so that there was an opportunity for life. And that's what this flood is all about. It was cleansing the swamp of all of the pollution that man had conceived that was stifling to life in the very place that Yahweh sought to sustain life. That's why when the children of Israel came back into the promised land, after having been treated as slaves for 400 years in Mitzrayim, in the crucible of human oppression, that the Hittites and Jebusites and the occupants of those towns had to be removed because they were hosts of the most deadly of all human pathogens. Religion. And if they were allowed to remain, it would be like moving into a home that was filled with rats with the bubonic plague, or filled with humans that had smallpox. Taking your children, your family, into a home where there are residents in that home that are plagued with smallpox is not the thing that a loving father would do.
So yeah, there was no hope for those people. They were too religious or political or militaristic or something. And they all had these names that meant things like that. It was just pretty well King of the Hill and, everything else. Clandestine bankers and, it was pretty wild stuff if you look at it. I mean, the Canaanites, I think they're still around,
Well, Yahweh does not in every place identify evil with religious, political, and militaristic institutions. He does in enough places, like Proverbs 6, for example, where so long as we're considering his testimony in the context of the whole, there's no mistaking that when Yahweh speaks of mankind being evil, he's speaking of the collective whole, of what man becomes as a collective. James, you sent me a quote from Winston Churchill, and I'm not going to attempt to quote it exactly. But what Winston Churchill said, he says, you know, while there can be and are noble qualities in individual Muslims, that the religion of Islam is one of the great foes of civilization, and that as an institution, that the imposition of Islam is wholly and completely counterproductive. And so I think the same thing is true of the land that was flooded by Yao. While there may have been individuals who by themselves were, you know, focused on raising their crops, raising their family, going about their lives, not attempting to do anything out of the ordinary. While individually, I'm sure there were some decent people in that regard. As a collective, mankind was ruthless, religious, misleading, duplicitous, deadly, vicious. And that's the difference between human institutions and their leaders and the masses. The leaders and their institutions poison the masses, largely because it is so difficult to be in opposition to it. I was writing on this new chapter, and I said, you know, when I was growing up, Jerry Falwell had this organization called the Moral Majority, and the concept was that if you were a right-wing Christian Republican, you would tell the secularists who were in opposition to the Vietnam War, America, love it or leave it. And this idea that even today, that you can go out and protest your country. Go to a football game in Texas and jibber jabber or stay seated while they're playing their national anthem. Or go to a baseball game and in the seventh inning when they sing God Bless America, be distracted, talk. Do something other than be reverent and see how people around you respond. My son was at a baseball game, not this year, but last year. And I think I've shared this before. When I'm at a sporting event and they're about to play the national anthem or have some kind of a moment of uniting religion and politics and the military, I always find an excuse to go to the can or to go to, you know, to get something to eat. I don't want to be in the stands. And so he got a little bit of a late start on that. And as they were had announced the national anthem but had not begun it, walked to leave his seat. And a bunch of guys got up and said, no, you get right back to where you were standing. You take your hat off. And you stay right here. Wouldn't let him walk away.
You got to be kidding me.
No, I believe it.
No.
There's
no.
Freedom. There's freedom.
Oh, yeah. No. America, love it or leave it. And, you know, and I began to realize that it is, not only is it extraordinarily difficult to walk away from one's country, something you must do if you're going to be part of the covenant, but the old slogan was right. That is the choice that God wants you to make. Are you going to love your country or love Him? Are you going to depend on your country or depend on Him? Are you going to serve your country or are you going to serve with Him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, I think that Obama and Clinton and Bush, I think they loved me, and I think at night when they go to bed. They're wondering, what can we do for old Lair tomorrow? You know, they're like born philanthropists, if you will. That's their position in life. They just love it.
What I have begun to recognize, too, is that something profoundly changed in America. If you go back to America 20 years ago, the great political debate was whether or not we should have a large military and invest in our military and deploy our military, or should we instead increase welfare and entitlement programs? Where should America spend their money? And what you had is the Democratic Party and the left wholly supportive of welfare programs and entitlement programs and wholly opposed to the military. And if you were a Republican, you were a hawk. If you were a Democrat, you were a dove. Now, today, there is no difference between the two. Today, just 20 years later, the Democratic Party is as pro-military, as patriotic, as pro-invasion, as is the Republican Party.
Oh, I know.
But that is a profound change in society that both liberal institution and conservative will both pay homage to the military and to troops and to and their rhetoric regarding adventurism and invasion and bombing is all the same. And even the left can't figure out that, you know, America invaded Afghanistan and made it worse. America invaded Iraq and made it worse. America bombed Libya and made it worse. America bombed Yemen and made it worse. America bombed Syria and made it worse. Why are we continuing to do that?
Because there's money in doing that by the people who sell the weaponry. And there's also control, because you get a certain amount of control out of every place with chaos. I mean, as you put it back together, you get to control it.
Well, I don't think that there is any control of the United States over the countries that we broke. We have no control over Iraq. We have no control.
Not at this moment.
We have no control.
Not at this
moment. But what we do, and we're never going to have control over those countries. But what we did, we simply broke them. But what you get is that by squandering truth, lives, and money in great masses, massive quantities of those things, in foreign countries, you get your citizens to forego their freedoms. You get their citizens to forego their wealth. And you create a political, militaristic state that is capable of enforcing its will, that people cannot rebel against. And so what they do is they deprive individuals of freedom, and they gain absolute control over their own citizens. So America didn't invade Iraq to control Iraq.
Oh, didn't say that. I said
control.
Out of
control
chaos
America.
Comes control, and
but
it doesn't have to be over
because
Iraq.
With,
it could be over anything.
Because with that, there was this enemy over there that we had to spy on, and we turned all of our spy apparatus on ourselves.
By the way,
and it was
by
the Department of Homeland Security that unified all of the policing agencies, so that we could create a Gestapo state.
Right.
We justified all of these things based upon the war over there to gain total control of people here.
Yeah, out of chaos comes control. Here you go. Sonia Young just chimed in, and she's got something to say to you, Craig. She takes great offense to your comments about Texas always. She says, too many New York foreigners in here from California, New York, and Washington. There you go. Coffee drinkers, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I've been on that one.
You just fight back for Texas, you know. You can't
fight
for Texas.
Yeah, I use Texas as an example because of what Texas religion and politics represents. For example, over this last week, I had the misfortune to read up on Mr. Cruz, who is running for President of the United States, who is likely to win the Iowa caucus because the Iowa caucus is comprised of white evangelical Christians. And they tell each other how Christian they are all the time. And so they're likely to support him. So I read what he believes, and I particularly read what his father, who goes on the campaign trail with him, believes. His father, in his most recent book, told all who would believe that the U.S. Constitution was inspired by God.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I heard that. It's laughable.
He said that not only is America a Christian nation, that no one is qualified to be president unless they began every day on their knees. He also said that God...
I guess I'm not qualified to be president.
Well, they're hiring those guys out of prison now. So, yeah, they're qualified.
Yeah. So it is... Texas is a place where there are tremendous freedoms economically because of the avoidance of state income tax. And so there is economically, I appreciate Texas for what it represents. Religiously, Texas is a few places in the country where no one asks, do you go to church? They ask, which church do you go to? Texas is a place where the military and politics and religion have all melded into one. And so if you view the things that God despises the most, religion, politics, militarism, Texas is a cesspool of those things.
Texas.
I'm a native Texan, born and bred. I live in a city that has less than about 2,000 people. We have about 15 to 20 churches and 3 gun stores in our small town.
I would go so far as to say that you put anything on your bumper sticker
against the Republican Party, and you're getting your car keyed.
Yeah. I would go so far as to say that Iowa's disdain for the religious and for the political is much greater than it is for the agnostic or even for the atheist. I don't think he really cares what the atheist says or does. I don't think he cares what the agnostic says or does. But I know that he views what the religious and political pontificate hatefully as an abomination.
Well, you know what the difference is, right?
Yeah.
The atheist doesn't speak in God's name. They don't claim to be speaking for him. The religious do.
That's correct. Yeah. The socialist secular humanist, the agnostic and the atheist, is not violating the instructions engraved in stone by Yahweh in the third statement that he wrote on the first of those two tablets. The religious person is. That's the difference.
You know what I get a lot?
What's that? William.
Yeah, and if you don't mind me just chiming in, because this individual, she's actually related to me, my cousin, she'll be listening to the archives, and if you guys wouldn't mind entertaining this, she had a few questions, and you know, she's just seeking. But one of the things that I get asked a lot is profanity sin.
No.
And I think people don't realize what sin is.
No.
You know, they seem to think that if you're not walking around.
Goddamn a lot. And goddamn is religiously is considered the ultimate profanity. I say goddamn a lot.
Don't you take the Lord's name in vain with me?
Yeah, well, we'll take the Lord's name because the Lord is Satan, and he has failed. So I'll do that with great regularity. Yahweh doesn't have a fixation on profanity, not that I've ever seen. I do think that we are wise when we convey concepts in a manner that's consistent with how Yahweh conveys concepts. Now, Yahweh uses very graphic language. So, for example, Yahweh says that the faces of those who pray to him, who are not Torah observant, appear to have bull dung on them. Now, that's you know, if you were to say that bullshit is a profanity, is a profound, is a profane statement, then Yahweh was even more graphic by saying bull dung. He says, the faces of those who pray to him, who are Torahless, are covered, are seen covered in bull dung. That's pretty graphic. You know, when Yosha's...
Well, even says worse than that, because that would be animal refuse. It would be the stuff,
right.
the fecal matter, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's just horrific. Yeah.
Right. And so when Yosha is hanging on the upright pole and citing Psalm 22, and he says, my God, why have you damned me? That's goddamn.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So, so to answer this individual's question, on a 1 to 10 scale, coarse language in this regard, graphic language, is not an issue. Yahweh himself uses very graphic language to convey his truth to us, and we should not be afraid to use very graphic language. Now, that said, I don't think that there is any advantage, for example, in lacing your commentary with F-bombs.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just, and when I get pushback from religious people when I'm sharing the truth, particularly about Islam, and I get a tirade of F-bombs, it simply discloses the lack of intelligence of the person making the claim. So I would say, use words as if they were the most precious resource in the universe. And make your words as similar and consistent with Yahweh's as is possible. And you will be rightly guided.
You know, there's nothing wrong with manners.
No.
Being polite, I mean, that's, you know.
Yeah, to a degree. Yahweh was angry. When he walked into the temple and there were scumbags there, he didn't ask them politely. He said,
that's not
hurtful and offensive. I would appreciate it if you would please leave.
No. I wouldn't expect that, no.
No, and when Yosha was discrediting the religious and political morons of his day, the language, that the terms that he used to depict them, hurtful.
Mm.
Intolerable.
Right, and he was sinless. Right, he was sinless. Well, the Torah says that sin is missing the mark. It's simply when you are not Torah observant, you're in sin.
Right.
You're sinning.
Yeah.
You're not upright.
I think it gets back to the thing that Larry, you've picked up so many times that I have said that is consistent with Yahweh's testimony, particularly relative to the word tzedak, particularly relative to the character and the persona known as Dot, is that the thing you want to be is right.
Mm-hmm.
If you're right in terms of your understanding and knowledge and response to the Torah, you're golden. If you're not right with that understanding and response, then you're going to be like the folks outside of the ark. You know,
well, there's,
Noah,
there's
the story
millions
of Noah is
of
so
people.
Important, and we're going to get to it next week. But the story of Noah is so important because, at its essence, Yahweh spoke to Noah because Noah was willing to listen to what Yahweh had to say, and Noah didn't say, "But God, that's really hard. That's not a very good plan because I have to do too much work." God, that's way overboard for the rain is going to come. Let's come up with a compromise. Noah listened to what Yahweh said, accepted what he had to say, acted upon what he had to say, and as a result, was delivered.
That's I remember when you first asked that question, Yada. Would you rather be good or right? And I was like, I'd rather be right because in being right, I can eventually be good, right?
Mm-hmm.
I can become a good person if I stay in the Torah. But there's a lot of good people in the world who do good things for other people, but they're not Torah observant. Yeah. So it does, they're not right.
Yeah.
They're
my,
not right.
My goal is never to be good. I mean, I think being good is has merit, but it's never a motivation. The motivation is to be right.
Right, and then being good, right? I mean, you and I, you know, I think we have our own standards of good. Oh, that's a good person. They treated me right.
Yeah, the Torah.
Right. The Torah is good.
If I'm right in my understanding of the Torah, then that's good. Then that's good. I'm good. It's good. You know, the Dode never strove to be good. I don't see Abraham striving to be good. I don't see Yosha striving to be good. I see Yosha as being right. I see Dode as being right. I see Moshe and Abraham and Noah. No, do you think, is there any place in there where Noah says, you know, God, I really want to be good today? No. In fact, it says that Noah was right in his family.
Yeah, it doesn't say at the end of some state, and he was polite. Yeah, you're one of the most polite people, in as far as I know, in the universe, it's the Iranians. They're more polite than anybody I know. They're more polite than our group by a ton.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. They're super polite people, no matter what.
Right. Yeah, so many times early on with Yadayah, I was attacked because I wasn't nice. I wasn't being polite. From their view, I wasn't being like Jesus. And I said, you know, what part of the Torah, prophets, and Psalms and the approach of Yahweh don't you understand? What part of the testimony of Yosha did you understand? Yosha's walking with the two guys that followed him during the last year or so, and he's walking with the two fellows on the way to Emmaus, and they are just dumbfounded by what has happened in Jerusalem and the fulfillment of the Moed Mikre. And what he says to the guys is, you're morons. You're just morons here.
Not very nice.
You say, you know, I'm so delighted that you were with me and that you're trying to figure this out, and I'm just so delighted with your approach here. No, he said, you're morons.
Yeah, but today the truth is harsh, and that's how they look at it. People are offended by the truth, and so be it.
Yeah. You know, and that's why I stopped doing chattering myths. I realized that the truth was so shrill and so harsh that there were far too few people who could, who were receptive to it, who could benefit from it. That the more you said it, the more people you were turning away. It is so shrill, so harsh, so inconsistent with the lie, that there's really no quarter for it today. And so I figured, why not just embrace the family?
Yeah.
Feed the family. Enjoy the family. And so you get back to writing, and you get back to a program like this where we get to talk as family about the family and nurture and benefit one another. And it seemed to me that was a better way to spend the next 10 years.
Yeah, well, you know, and speaking of that, you know, like, what if, you know, we were talking about Texas. What about New Yoreco? What about that? I mean, I don't hear a lot of Yahweh being talked about up there. Come on, you guys.
No,
that's true.
We're, I spent the last 15 years of my life in the South, in Virginia. And in Virginia, they're not very fond of Yanks.
No.
So, I'm here to tell you that I think that mankind is rapidly devolving, and that the ears and eyes that are open to what Yahweh has to say are becoming rapidly fewer, and that the consequence of telling the truth is going to become more egregious, and that people are going to respond to a world that is spinning out of control in very inappropriate ways. I was writing IQ yesterday, and what I shared with IQ is that he needs more than ever to begin every interview he does with the statement that use your words, don't use bullets and bombs. Do not lash out aggressively, because he's going to be blamed for the aggression of others.
Yeah.
Because people are going to get mad as hell. You know, an article finally came out in a mainstream periodical, CNN, reported what's happening in Germany by the thousands. Women are being raped and robbed by the Muslims.
Yep, that's right.
And it's happening by the thousands. And and while CNN and everyone else is printing their little stories about how you know some little girl is promoting is standing up to the mischaracterization of Islam, that Islam is continuing to do what Islam does, and as it continues to be what it is, or the embodiment of evil, people in Europe are going to do exactly what IQ predicted. They're going to rise up against it. And most of those who do, the vast preponderance, are going to do so ignorantly and in the wrong way. They're going to say, this is, you know, it's like America did with Saddam Hussein. Okay, Saddam Hussein and his sons were bad dudes. Okay? So what are you going to do about it? That realization, if you lash out aggressively, violently at it, simply going to make a bad situation worse, which is what we did, because we didn't view the problem in context. We didn't use the right tool. And that's what's going to happen in Europe, and it's going to happen in the United States. Today, a Muslim, I think it was in Philadelphia, went and said, in the name of Islam, and started fired 11 rounds into a police car.
Wow.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I thought he killed him. Maybe I could be wrong.
Yeah, they could have. I just read the first part of it.
You absolutely said, in the name of Islam, I'm going to.
Yeah.
I'm doing
it all over the bar.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that, but you know, right beside it was a CNN article on people's irrational phobia against the Arabic language and how the Arabic language has been so vital, so much at the center of human progress.
Oh, sure. Irrational. Sure, they invented nearly everything.
The, opposed to the Arabic language, with no realization that the it's the language of the most vile, most terroristic, most deadly book ever written, the Quran. That it is the language that was spoken by, as a percentage of humankind at the time, by the most murderous people who ever lived. When the Muslims, after Muhammad's death in the first 100 years of Islam, killed a higher percentage of the world's population than it's been any entity has ever done prior or since. That it's the language spoken by those who commit 99% of the world's terrorist acts. And you want to ignore all of that because somebody that Christopher Columbus might have consulted to make calculations on the Earth being round, wrote their analysis in Arabic, or that because of the slaves of the Muslims, that the number zero is attributed to Islam as opposed to the Indians who were their slaves, and that's your justification. Wow.
Yeah, I have another question for you, gentlemen, if you don't mind. And I've answered these questions to the best of my ability, but I'd like for her to get a third party perspective here. She asks, since you don't follow any religion, and the word of Yahweh is not a religion, what would following His word be considered? Monotheism, tradition?
Well, Yahweh
does not use terms like that. He has no word for religion, and he certainly does not like human tradition. So, following Yahweh's testimony, the terms that he would use would be shamar, to observe, to closely examine and carefully consider his word, dabar. Since Torah means teaching and guidance, it means to be guided by His testimony, to be guided by His teaching. Why would you want a word to describe that when those words depict it beautifully. The end result is to be included in his covenant family. That's the end result. And the path to it is to closely examine and carefully consider, to come to know and understand who Yahweh is, what he's offering, and then act upon it.
It's called a family covenant, is what it's called, and the Torah is a map. It's a map. If you want to call it something, it's a map.
Yeah.
There you go. You know, I mean, Yahweh clearly says,
light provides guidance. Maps provide guidance. It is a directional masterpiece. And, just because humans want to equate themselves to Republican or Democrat, to Italian or English, to liberal or conservative, to Christian or Muslim, doesn't mean that God wants to. And so why should we apply the terms that Yahweh despises to the things that he loves?
You know, I have a note called How Much Religion is Found in the Family Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, I've come to the conclusion that it's zero. And it's based upon the words of the Creator. Here's what he says. We all want to end up in the land as adopted family, do we not? I mean, 100% of us. I mean, if you're you're covenant, that's where you're going to be. Instead, it says, indeed, and this is Yahweh's words, when you come into the land associated with Yahweh, your God has given to you, you shall not accept, teach, imitate, or perform any of the disgusting religious ways of the Gentile nations. Okay? Now, if that's true, and that is true, that's what he said, how many of the religions do you know of that bow before either an altar or a cross or some object or to
all
each
of
other? Thank you. So should we be bowing to anybody?
They had different names for their gods.
Mm-hmm.
But they were perpetrated and orchestrated all the same. And so the fact is that Yahweh was saying, if you want to enter the promised land, which is to live with him, you cannot embrace, tolerate, accept any religious or political notion, because that's the Goyim nations are consistent, America being one of them. As is the Goyim church. Don't do it.
And it wouldn't matter. Don't all these religions, they all have bowing, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
And Yahweh calls bowing a curse, doesn't he? It's a curse.
They all have priests or religious clerics. They all have
religious buildings, temples.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They all extract money from
religious
buildings. And they demand allegiance.
Yep. So
they
why would we
are,
imitate
whatever country they existed in, they were all amalgamated with the politics of that country, with the leadership of that country. The militaries of those countries all fought in the name of that religion and God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So here's my last question, because this is one I get all the time. I'm sure everyone in the chat room gets it. I'm sure you guys get it all the time, especially Yada, right? So this is, how are you exactly sure of what you are reading and referencing to be true?
Well, Yahweh fills those
the way that you do that is to closely examine and consider what is written.
It's
you know, if you're willing to invest the time with an open mind and the energy to diligently examine the words that Yahweh has conveyed in the language that he conveyed them, then you will be confronted with absolute consistency, absolute brilliance, and with statements that are way beyond the capacity of humanity. And if God made one statement, like, for example, as we were talking with Roy, the realization that we can prove that from the perspective of the Creator at creation, that the 15 billion years transpired over six 24-hour days, And he revealed that 3,500 years ago in the context of relativity, and then goes through and presents each epoch of creation in the right order with the right depiction of what occurred, and that our investigations affirm everything that he had to say. And then he has prophetic testimony woven into that as to what's going to happen, for example, on the fourth day, year 4,000, Yah, in the fulfillment of the Moed. And then you find affirmations of, for example, the flood, where he says it's going to be begun with an upwelling of seawater. And you find the Burkle impact crater at that time, and you find all the residue from the Black Sea all the way up through Mesopotamia of precisely this flood occurring, exactly where he said it was going to occur, where it occurred. And then you read the thousands of prophecies that were written way before their fulfillment, particularly those in Daniel, where the great swath of human history, all the way to the days we're living in today, was all presented. And so the only thing that causes the person who asked you that question to ask that question, and for us not to ask that question, is that we've taken the time to thoughtfully, carefully, and thoroughly consider what Yahweh has to say. And you do that for a reasonable amount of time, and you migrate from questioning and wanting to know to knowing, to being absolutely certain. So the answer to the question is that individual that asked the question doesn't know, and we know, simply because we were willing to invest the time to know.
And Yahweh says, my children are separated from me due to lack of knowledge. He never says
right.
Lack of faith. Faith is a pagan
right.
concept, the idea of believing in the unknown.
Why do they lack knowledge, Larry?
Well, because they've never studied the Torah.
Right.
They don't.
Right. What's the solution to lacking knowledge?
Go study the Torah.
Right.
Yeah.
In fact, Yahweh actually explains that two statements after he says, my children are destroyed for lack of knowing. He explains that what they don't know, what they've rejected, is his Torah teaching. And so the answer to the question is that you don't know, and we know, time to know. We've made an effort to know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone has ever read, for example, questioning Paul and remained a Christian. I don't think any agnostic has ever read Yada Yada from beginning to end and remained an agnostic. I don't think it's possible to devote the time necessary to read, for example, an intro to God from beginning to end and not have it profoundly influence your understanding and your very nature. I don't think it's possible, but I think that the overwhelming percentage of people would prefer simply to pose a simplistic question, looking for a simplistic answer, and they will never know because they're never willing to devote the time and the energy to know, and they're unwilling to go where the words lead.
And I have to tell you, I don't see how you even get through any of those books completely. Right? I mean, they're great tools. They're great tools. But if you stop and you start the research,
uh-huh.
and I would say with Intro to God right at the very beginning, I mean, you provide references. It's like...
And all the tools. Intro to God.
You almost don't get to finish the book.
Everything that I've written.
Right. You just start, one thing leads to another, and by the time you're done just researching that little bit of information, I mean, a year might have gone by.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and then you develop your own conviction.
Right.
I want to
know your favorite pastime. You know, if your choice is, I can go off and play golf today, and I can learn more, you're going to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
I once had a guy tell me that he read some of your stuff, Craig. He just
yeah.
read
oh, yeah.
He read some of your stuff. You know, like it just, it's the kind of thing you walk in at the dentist's office and,
you know, under the counter, really there's the three types
coffee
of floss,
table.
And you read the back of the floss container, and it says some of the stuff is there.
Yeah, I said, so you read like a 3,000 page tome, you know, on a... I thought it was pretty laughable. I said, you know,
what that comes down to is they read the very first page in introduction and then decided to dismiss it.
Yeah, you know, I think that, and I was writing this in the in this new observations volume that they've just begun, and you know, it is a matter of, are you willing to invest the time and energy to know what Yahweh had to say in the language he used to say it. And for that, you have to be able to translate Hebrew. And, you know, that is not a difficult skill to learn. There are marvelous tools that aid in that process. And everyone that's here, William, you've just alluded to this, if you read the translations that I've attempted to comprise, and I think that while they're imperfect, they are better than what you're likely to find elsewhere. But because they provide all of the tools surrounding them and the thought process that went into the translations and all the tools to verify them for yourself, it empowers the reader to go from being dependent on somebody else's work to being themselves self-sufficient in this investigation, and that's what it requires.
Can I share something here real quick?
Sure.
It's very easy.
Okay.
Shaba Baha Yom Halal. Now, Shaba or Sheba, one means promise, the other, of course, means seven.
Mm-hmm.
Seven is the promise.
Mm-hmm.
Haba Yom, anybody who knows about Yom Kippurim knows that's the day of Kippur. During the day, Halal, I will come to radiate your light. Now, those of us that understand the seven Moed Mikra, that's telling us on the seventh day we're going to be wrapped in the Torah or in the light of the Torah.
Right.
That's pretty clear. Now, I just want to read, I just want to read, and this will be pretty easy, what it says in a book literally named after the sun goddess Biblius, and
right.
Also with Baal.
Under Bible, the root of Bible in Hebrew means confusion.
Just like Biblios, I'm sure the sun goddess too. Now it says seven, they got that right, is the promise. They says times a day, doesn't say seven times a day. It says seven is the promise during the day. I praise you for your righteous laws. Now, the word praise isn't in there. Tzedak, which means righteous, isn't in there. And laws, I guess they're calling Torah laws, that's not in there. Who's
right.
writing these goddamn religious books? Because they
right.
just wrote their own piece. It had
yeah.
nothing to do with what Dode was saying in Psalm 119, 164.
So why
this is one example
why be
of thousands.
That the text in a book named With Baal, that is named after the Hebrew word for confusion, would be confusing, would be corrupt. Why should we be surprised? They define it as such. You know, it's like when we found out that the Masoretic system that the Jews used to misrepresent the name of Yahweh was called Shav, which means to corrupt, to deceive. That when we found that they actually named their system Shoah, to corrupt and to deceive, it's the same thing as Christians calling their corruption and deception Bible. It's right in your face.
So why does it not resonate? I mean, I know that's a rhetorical question. It's becoming a rhetorical question to me, but I'm going.
I think it gets back to the same thing.
Bread in the head.
Are you willing to invest the energy and time to learn? And are you willing to go where the words lead? It doesn't resonate because the vast preponderance of people are not willing to invest the energy and time to validate those statements. And there would be unwilling otherwise to even go where the words lead. If the words lead away from something that they hold dear, they're not going there. Yeah. You know, you're
what if I would have told you
started that with, it was trying to proclaim the fact that Jesus is found in the Septuagint. If you confront that individual with Yahweh's testimony, with evidence and reason that makes what they're saying come across as it is, as stupid, they're not going there. They're never going to
get that
Jesus.
I did that. He began quoting some religious whore who makes a Dr. somebody Brown. You know, I don't care about Dr. Brown. He's a whore. You know, it's like Nehemiah Gordon to me. I mean, the special Karaite Jew that can't find Yahusha in the entire Tanakh. Wow.
Well, I was asked to go ahead and sit with my, I guess he'd be a great uncle. He has a doctorate in theology, and he has a church, a Pentecostal church, and I was told to contact him that he could set me free. Well, I would love to see
that. The guy that can't find the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, it's written 220 times.
But it blows my mind that they think because people have doctorates that they're right.
Well, yeah, what I told this guy who was a follower of, this was the day before yesterday, of Nehemiah Gordon.
Gordon,
what I said to him was, so when he meets Yahweh, everybody else, you know, they're following Yahweh's words and they're paying close attention to the instructions, but he'll just pull out his credentials on them. Because he was impressed with these list of credentials. And Yahweh will, of course, succumb to these amazing credentials. Because, after all, he's a special Karaite Jew. You know, give me a break. That's stupid.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
I think
Yahweh likes the blue collar guy.
Listen to what the caller has to say as opposed to what Yahweh has to say.
That's exactly what he said.
I was going to be standing there at the door. Where did you get your seminary degree? Oh, you don't have one? You can't come in here.
You didn't go to Holy Cross. What are you doing here?
Who are you a follower of? Who are you a follower of? How about the Torah? Right answer. Right answer.
But hasn't Yahweh left us enough evidence, which is tangible and intangible, to prove his existence?
Absolutely.
That's plenty.
More than enough.
No, I don't think you even have to get. You don't even have to get through the first half a dozen chapters of the first book of the Torah without being confronted with so much proof that only a nincompoop could come to any conclusion other than the author of this testimony is in fact the Creator God of the universe.
That's right. That's right. But see, it's funny because when you if you really want to go down that road and talk about credentials, which I did respond in this way, I'm like, all right, well, great. Well, guess what? We got a scientist that agrees with us, and he's a scientist.
Yeah.
How many doctorates do you think he has?
Now I won't go there. I like Roy.
Yeah.
I like listening to Roy. I don't care that Roy agrees. I really don't.
Right, but
I really don't.
No, I'm just saying.
Yeah. I only like, and I don't ever seek affirmation anywhere other than the Torah. And right now, I don't even seek affirmation in the Torah because I have more affirmation than I could ever. I've long since reached the point where another affirmation is meaningless. The only thing that's meaningful is the added insight and enlightenment that comes from the next statement that I dissect. But the reason I like having conversations with Roy has nothing to do with affirmation. It has always to do with added perspective, a depth of
deeper understanding.
Yeah, it. For example, when he makes a statement, I had never thought of the idea that Yahweh in the seventh dimension does not know his own future and cannot know his own future. I had never thought of that before, but as you reason your way through it, it's brilliant. When Roy speaks of, and I understood this concept, but about the ability to have positive genetic migrations because our DNA has been supplied with the capacity for it. While I recognized that that was true. I had never thought about it in the context of a father raising children and supplying their children with insights and capacity to deal with what life brings them well beyond the moment that they are conveying that information. And how when you transition from knowing to understanding, you are really empowered and equipped. We are empowered and equipped with our understanding of Yahweh and His Torah to deal with whatever the world brings our way. You know, I could go into any debate with any religious person anywhere in the world and prevail because I've been equipped with the upward mobility that understanding the Torah provides.
Oh, you mean we can handle poisonous snakes and serpents? Is that what
right.
you mean?
Yeah.
So, let me make a
powerful thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me make this clear. It's not about affirmation. It's not even about what the person has as far as their credentials. I could care less. My point of contention was simply, it's about Yahweh's words. I don't care if it's a homeless person sharing with me.
Right.
If what that person says makes sense to me, I'm going to go ahead and do my due diligence and do the research.
Yeah.
And whether they be a scientist, a doctor, an alcoholic, I don't care as long as the words make sense. And
if
the light goes off, I'm going to go check. That's all I'm saying.
There is an affirmation that I find in other people. Like your persona and character, having embraced and now sharing the Torah, I find affirming. I find Terry and Kirk's path to the covenant and the result affirming. I find James having been an agnostic and grappling with these issues and then going and doing an investigation of himself affirming. I find a rascal like Larry who finds the one straight game in town and then embraces it. That's affirming. There's a unity of purpose and of passion that is consistent with the family. All of us flawed. All of us have our issues, but there's a common sense of purpose and passion that I find that affirming.
Right.
I find that same thing, by the way, in Roy. He comes to the same conclusions for the same reason and is motivated by exactly the same process and is excited by the same process. It's almost a childlike wonderment in all of us.
Yeah, and to add to you know, affirming, I mean, only Yahweh could do what he does, right? I mean, if you look, Fred posted something on FB the other day, and I started to look at all the different people responding from all different places in the world, and I'm like, man, only Yahweh could do that. Rich, poor, black, white, I don't care what you are, and we all love each other. Genuine.
All over the world. All over the world.
All over the world. And I'm looking at this and I'm just blown away by it. I'm like, wow, you know?
Yeah. I find that affirming.
Only Yahweh could do that.
But I don't find that affirming in the sense of adding to my conviction. I find it affirming in the same way that I find every statement that I translate from Yahweh and think about just affirms who he is, what he's offering, and what the benefit is.
It's a beautiful family, I can tell you that.
It is.
It's a beautiful family.
Is. And it's going to continue to be. Yeah. Well, fellas, we're 30 minutes beyond our broadcast time. I've enjoyed...
Did you go over again?
I did.
You went over again.
I did. I'm a very poor manager of time. And by the way, you know how many of the passages that we were going to cover tonight that we actually stated?
Zero.
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 There's a concept for you. We were
sorry, guys.
I had it up. I had it ready to go. I had read through it. I was ready and prepared.
And you got bushwhacked, man. You got bushwhacked.
I'm so
easy.
Yeah. All right. So I guess it's five Eastern, two out there in La La Land, where you are, Kirk, that we're going to dial in with Scott. He said he's going to be
ready. I thought it was three Eastern.
No, 2 o'clock California time.
Oh, okay, no, so we're doing 5 o'clock. Okay.
Yeah, it's 5 o'clock, 4 o'clock Central, and he says he thinks he'll be available prior to 4 o'clock Central. That's 5 Eastern on Sunday.
Okay, I'll send you an outline, and then y'all can.
Okay. I don't really need an outline. Whatever
the
easiest way is.
What
I would like to be able to introduce, kind of the same thing I did with Roy. I have enough understanding of what you're going to present that I can introduce it, ask questions, and then get us to pause from time to time to reflect on on how it relates to what we know about Yala.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Look forward to it.
Fair enough. All right, guys.
Y'all.
All right, go on.
Bye, guys.
Talk to you guys.
All right.
Good night,
Bye.
Good night, John.
Good night.